Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Dr. Kiki's Science Hour is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Dr. Kiki's Science Hour with Dr. Kiki, episode number 49 for Monday, June 7th, 2010, The Bugs Among Us. This episode of Dr. Kiki's Science Hour is brought to you by Audible.com. To download a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/Kiki. Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Dr. Kiki's Science Hour. A full hour of science to talk about science. I mean, it's how often do you get this? An entire hour dedicated to science. Today, we're going to be talking about bugs. Well, not creepy crawly bugs like centipedes or butterflies or mosquitoes, those kinds of bugs. I'm talking about teeny tiny, tiny critters that are microscopic in size, but that basically dominate this planet. And who knows, they may potentially dominate other planets, but we haven't figured that out yet for sure. Last week was the general meeting for the American Society for Microbiology, and I was inundated with news about what was happening in the world of microbes, bacteria, archaea bacteria, and viruses. All week long, I was hearing all this amazing stuff coming out of San Diego where the meeting took place. So I thought to myself, hey, maybe this is something that we should talk about on the Science Hour. Spend an entire hour talking about microbes. And to do so, we are joined today by Dr. Stanley Malloy from San Diego State University. He is the Dean of the College of Sciences, the Associate Director for the Center for Microbial Sciences. So he's coming from a pretty good place of expertise on this subject. His lab works on host specificity for Salmonella bacteria, why and how this pathogen's chromosomes are able to rearrange themselves during reproduction, how they exchange genes from one organism to another. They actually can take genes and give them to another of their kind. And additionally, they work on the development of new vaccines against pathogenic bacteria. So I am extremely interested in hearing his take on the news coming out of the meeting from the Society for Microbiology, and additionally talking about anything that he thinks is really interesting and cool about microbes. Welcome, Stanley. It's wonderful to have you joining me today.
It's wonderful to join you. Thanks very much, Kiki.
You're welcome. Now, I'm wondering, first off, microbes, what makes them so interesting to you?
You said microbes control everything on our Earth, control geology, they control weather, they control ecological processes, as well as things we normally think of, like health and bioremediation and so on. So what's not to like?
What's not to like? Maybe the pathogenic ones.
Well, I think we have to understand those better so that we can do something about them. And so it makes studying them fun because you feel like you're doing something important for people.
Is it difficult to study microbes? I mean, they're so small. I mean, I've heard news stories, reports, read papers that we have completely different populations of bacteria on our right hand from our left hand. Or, you know, there are just populations of multiple kinds of bacteria that are inside of our bodies, on our bodies. But we can't see them. Is it really difficult to be able to study these creatures?
So, you know, a lot of the excitement in biology, as you know, being a neurobiologist, is understanding things at the molecular level. And molecules are also way too small for us to see, but we have ways to study them. That said, this is really, really exciting time in microbiology because of exactly what you said. a few years back, we didn't have a good way of telling what's different between the microbes on our right hand and our left hand. And now we can answer questions like that, but potentially ones that have more impact than right versus left.
Right. The right hand versus left hand example isn't necessarily something that's going to really impact your daily life, I would guess.
It may influence how you shake hands with somebody.
Hearing about that story, though, or the bacteria that cover us, it just makes me think that certain cultures might have it right in terms of not shaking hands.
I just went to commencement the other day, and I shook hands with 2,700 people all in a row.
Oh, so, my gosh.
Think of all the microbes you're picking up.
Did you go home to your Purell? Being a microbiologist, do you have a large supply of Purell? Does it make you a little bit nervous about social situations?
I'm not nervous about social situations because we are well adapted to protect ourselves from most things. But I did use the Purell after shaking all those hands, for sure.
So getting into the academic stuff, last weekend was the general meeting for the Association of Microbiologists, or the American Society for Microbiology. What was really, really striking to you about the meeting from last week? Was there anything that really just came out and hit you from the meeting?
I think that there were a couple of things. So first, this is a big meeting. There are 88 people and thousands of talks and presentations. So there was a lot of really good stuff. But what's most exciting is the impact of our ability to seek the genomes and genes of organisms. What that's allowing us to learn about organisms, how organisms interact, and what's going on in nature. And that really was the theme that went throughout the meeting. It's been a revolution in the way we think.
A revolution, just the way that it, being able to look at these creatures as how we exist with them, and right. Actually thinking of them more so. And I mean, I guess they've out of sight, out of mind historically.
So let me give you an example of something that we learned a few years ago, that the microbes that are in the gut of mice can have a profound influence on whether the mice become obese, right? Yeah. Now, two mice, kept in separate cages, fed the same diets, but they differ in terms of what the microbes are in their guts. One gets obese, the other doesn't. That is an earth-shattering discovery, right?
Absolutely.
And so the question is, well, is it mice, or is this true of humans too? And so one of the things that was really exciting at this meeting was people were beginning to analyze bacteria associated with the intestines of a variety of types of humans, and to be able to figure out if this correlation is true in humans as it is in mice. Now, one of the studies that was really pretty phenomenal was a study that came out of Claire Leggett's University of Maine. They basically used sequence analysis to look at the microbes that are in the gut of people in the old Amish groups in Pennsylvania, right? So this is a culture where the people live very similar lifestyles, where they have very similar genetic backgrounds. And so you can do the comparisons in that group of people that would be very hard in others.
Yeah.
What do you think the answer is?
I would guess that it's probably very similar to the outcome found in mice. That's just logically, it doesn't seem that there would be much of a reason that I could think of physiologically that we'd find a difference, unless it has to do specifically with the specific types of bacteria that are found there.
Right. So when they did this study, because of the mouse work, their hypothesis was that the microbes in the gut would be an important determinant. Right? But when they did this study, they found differences in the microbes of in the guts of these people, but it wasn't a simple correlation. So they went back and they looked at genes in those people that sometimes have a correlation with obesity. And the really amazing thing was they found it's not just those genes and it's not just the bacteria. It's whether you have certain types of bacteria as well as certain human genes. So wow. It really is the two working together. Yeah, that's pretty phenomenal, I think.
Yeah, that's absolutely fascinating. The idea that that the genes and the bacteria are actually working in concert to determine the outcome. So if you don't have specific genes, but you have the certain bacteria, nothing's going to happen.
Right.
If you have the don't have the genes, but you have the bacteria, vice versa, it doesn't happen. But you have to have both at the same time.
Yeah,
that's impressive.
So this is what's now called the human microbiome, and the idea is that as a human, it's not just our human genetic makeup; it's all of the cells that are associated with us. And there are 10 times more bacteria on humans than there are human cells, and about 100 times more microbial genes than human genes that are part of us. That being the case, it's really not surprising that the microbes and the human genes have these kinds of interactions. But, you know, 10 years ago, this would have been blasphemy.
Yeah. Yeah. That it's amazing. It's hard to comprehend sometimes how many more microbes there are. I mean, the 10 times, the 100 times the number of human genes. How do you tell a microbial gene from a human gene since we're so integrated? And is it even worth telling them apart? Shouldn't we just say genes?
That's a great question. I think that it probably is worth telling them apart. And the reason is when you take something like obesity, and there's a whole bunch of other diseases that are correlated with obesity, like diabetes and so on. The treatment that we have now for those are all based on changing human behavior. And changing human behavior in an individual is very hard. Changing in a population is extremely hard. Yeah. But if we can go in and change the bacteria and decrease obesity, think of the impact on human health.
Yeah, it's huge. The potential for impact is just would be astounding. You know, something as simple as changing the bacterial population, although that at this point in time it's not simple to do, but something that simple having such an effect on people's health, because obesity goes into all sorts of other health issues that come as a result.
Right, absolutely. But that's really exciting. We're starting to cover these things. So another area that to this concept, it's different, and that we've seen what's lapse of B colonies since about 2006.
Can you say that again? You're breaking up a little bit.
A collapse of B colonies.
Yes.
So you'd have a hive of bees, and every winter a certain percentage of them die off. But we started to see where somewhere 50-80%, very large percentage of the bees would all of a sudden just die off and spread around the country. So the question is, what the heck is going on?
Yeah.
So people said, well, maybe it's this one pathogen or maybe it's this other pathogen. And you couldn't put a finger on any single type of infection. What it looks like now is small that happening at one time. So it's a team of organisms, a team of pathogens that get together to wreak havoc with the colonies.
Yeah, and is that do you think did they talk about that at all at the meeting in terms of having like a fungal infection that occurs first that kind of leads the way for the bacterial infection, and then it's a number of different bacteria that team up? Is that the current working hypothesis?
That's absolutely the idea. But again, this is one of these things where a few years back, if it was one organism causing one disease, we could begin to understand it. But it was very hard for us. We didn't have the tools to understand where there are multiple organisms, each doing this kind of teamwork to cause a disease like this.
Right. And is this kind of thing becoming more and more common in infection research, where our researchers finding that it's not so much just a single organism, say like Salmonella infection another one's not coming to me, but just where in some cases it's a single, are we now finding that now it's a number of bacterial infections or microbial little tiny creature infections teaming up together?
I think that we've just the tip of the iceberg. So beginning to understand that more types of diseases that on a time were quirk of the environment or something like that, we're beginning to realize that they're caused by these multi-microbial types of processes. So have we discovered a lot of them so far? Not really, maybe a handful. Are we going to within the next few years? I'm convinced from the data that was presented at this ASM meeting that we will in pretty short order. And I think it will have an impact on human health, because if you know that the infection is caused by bacteria, if you know the disease is caused by them, you can develop antimicrobials, or you can use vaccines, or you can use approaches that are different than the disease simply caused by barbecuing your bacon.
Right. In terms of the genes that are, or the way that the bacteria are influencing health, and the way that maybe it's influencing phenotypes, and the way that genes are being expressed, can we maybe think of microbes and their effects on humans, at least, as a type of epigenetics? Do you think that's fair?
I think that's a very reasonable way of thinking of them. It's a really different way of thinking of them. Yeah. You won't find that in any textbook, I don't think. but absolutely. Absolutely.
What other stuff did you hear at the meeting that was really interesting to do? I know that about the same time, Craig Venter and the Venter Institute announced the synthetic bacterial their synthetic bacteria. Is that something that was discussed a lot there, or was that?
There was a tremendous amount of discussion about that at the meeting. It was really very interesting. And one of the contributors to that work, Clyde Hutchinson, actually gave a talk at the meeting that was a packed house. And he did a wonderful job of explaining what they did. You know, I'm convinced that this is a really important discovery, but it's one of these situations where sometimes there's so much hype, it's hard to do the evaluation of how important really is it,
right,
versus how much is hype, right? And the hype comes about from using terms like creation of synthetic life.
Artificial life. We've created artificial life. Those were the headlines that were coming. I mean, I kept going, whoa, artificial life, really? And looking deeper, I don't know if it really fits that definition.
Right. But so I think that this is really important. And let me, just in case there are listeners who haven't followed this story, let me give a brief summary of what happened, okay?
Yes, please.
So the basic idea is there are a couple of kinds of microbes that don't have a cell wall. These are really very simple. They're basically a membrane surrounding some DNA and cytoplasm that's needed to do all of the metabolism associated with life. So what they did was they knew the full genome sequence of some of these organisms. These are called mycoplasma. And since they knew that full genome sequence, they could take it and in vitro, in the laboratory, do a complete synthesis of that entire genome, some clever trick. Process made an entirely new genome.
Can you say start over from in the process? It was breaking up just a little bit.
In the process of making this new genome, this new DNA sequence, put parts in there, they watermarks. So these are stretches of DNA that identify that synthetic DNA sequence from the one that's present in nature. Mm. Overall, they copied the genome from nature because they knew that genome had all of the stuff necessary for life. Okay? So now they took this genome that they had completely made in vitro. It was a copy from nature, but they made it in vitro, and they moved it in to the membrane of a different mycoplasma. And once it was in that new mycoplasma, it kicked out the first mycoplasma genome, and it replicated. And it replicated 10 to the 9th time to produce a whole colony of exactly the same thing. And by the time you've reproduced that many times, you've diluted out essentially everything that was there first, right?
Right.
So what they did was they synthesized this in vitro, which was really clever and okay. But the amazing thing was their ability to move this across the membrane and get it to reproduce many, many times in the cell. In the case of mycoplasma, it may not have that many practical applications, but it's very easy to think about how if you add more bristles to this, modify a genome to do certain processes that you want, to make certain kinds of products be really useful, to do a variety, degrade oil or to generate energy or what have you. And so the process of making it in vitro and moving it into this membrane, no one has done it in quite that way before. I think it's really very, very exciting.
So it's important in the proof of concept of being able to do what they've done. A lot of these techniques are techniques that have existed separately, but not necessarily been put together in quite this specific manner. And they've also started a potential process of being able to, at one point, like you said, be able to modify genomes and insert genetic information that might be useful for something that we're looking to have done.
It's not incredible. I think that's important to realize. It took some techniques to make the show that it existed. In fact, their group developed the best way, and they improved on those techniques.
Okay.
The key thing, moving into the membrane, it's a process called transcription. I think, personally, that is huge. I wouldn't be surprised if there's a Nobel Prize sitting here somewhere.
Wow. Wow, that is big. Can you hold on for one moment? I'm going to give a brief word to our sponsor. And additionally, the audio has been breaking up, unfortunately. So what I think I'm going to want to do to make sure that we have a better audio feed is if you can turn off your video, but don't hang up, just turn off the video, and then we'll hopefully that will make the audio a little bit better, and we'll be able to have a conversation that continues. Keep it going. Yes. Okay, so word from the sponsor. I'd like to take this moment to thank Audible.com for sponsoring Dr. Kiki's Science Hour. Audible.com is the leading provider of audiobooks with over 75,000 titles in their library. They have titles in all sorts of genres, all the way from science fiction to, of course, science, from history to, biographies, autobiographies, fiction, fantasy, periodicals, all sorts of books are available to you, and you can download them in the MP3 format or a nice audio format for whatever kind of portable player or desktop computer you might have. You can download it to your computer, put it into any device, take it with you on the road, makes it very convenient for your listening the way that you would like to have listening happen in your life. Now, this week, it is the first week of June, so I'd like to make the book of the month for our Audible pick, book of the week, for the Twists Book Club book of the month, which is by Sean Carroll. So let me get the book up here really fast. Sean Carroll. Let's see if I can get the name right. I'll pull it up. Sean Carroll's From Eternity to Here. It is the quest for the ultimate theory of time. Now, this book is the This Week in Science Book Club Book of the Month, and we're going to be reading it all month long. So one way you can read it is on the go. So you can download the book, listen to it, and then you can go to the Twist Book Club and talk about it and have a whole group of people to share your ideas with. Sean Carroll, From Eternity to Here, The Quest for the Ultimate Theory of Time. It's going to be a great read. I am really excited about reading it. Maybe we'll get Sean Carroll on the show at some point for an interview. Who knows? And if you download the book as your free audiobook download, because that's what Audible's doing, they're giving you a free audiobook download. If you sign up for a trial today, you can know what's going on when that interview comes around. So it sounds pretty good to me. Anyway, go to audiblepodcast.com/Kiki, K-I-K-I. It's audiblepodcast.com/Kiki. Sign up for your free trial today. Get a free audiobook download. It's awesome. Get a free book. Woohoo! It'll be great. And play along with everybody. We like it. So, audiblepodcast.com/Kiki for your free audiobook download right now, today. Go do it. Thank you very much, audible.com, for sponsoring this hour of Dr. Kiki Science Hour. And now, back to the show. Let's see. Dr. Malloy, how does your audio sound now?
Can you hear me better now?
That sounds pretty good right now. We'll see how,
all right.
We'll see if it keeps going this way. Well,
So let me tell you one of the other things I thought was really exciting at this meeting.
Please do.
And that is, we had a special session on bioremediation of oil spills, right? A very timely topic.
Extremely timely. And I've been hearing people talk about it a lot. Why aren't we doing something? Why are we putting toxic chemicals into the Gulf right now? Maybe can we just add bacteria?
So this is a really interesting topic. So we had two guys come and talk about it. Ron Atlas, who has had a tremendous amount of experience working on oil spills in the past, major oil spills in the past. And Jay Grimes, who actually works in a lab right there off of the coast where the oil spill was. And so the amazing thing here is that there are a lot of people who've come up with complicated ways to develop microbial processes to degrade oil, but it ends up the very best thing that you can do is simply add fertilizer, right?
Fertilizer.
It's not quite the same as the fertilizer you'd add to your garden, but the basic idea is that where there's oil, the microbes that can degrade the oil exist. And so if you simply enhance their growth by providing them with some key nutrients, they will begin degrading that oil. Now, it's really very different than some kind of complicated and expensive process that it takes to degrade oil, but it's just as efficient, just as fast, and it doesn't leave behind any organisms that weren't there to begin with. So it's a very important process. Now, you're not going to be able to degrade the oil until you slow the flow. We're dumping so much oil out in the Gulf right now that it's a non-issue at this point. But in short order, when they get things capped up, I hope in short order, then this is going to be a real important issue for us to clean up the wetlands, and especially the near shore areas of the oil that's left there. So that was a very exciting talk at the meeting. And I think it surprised a lot of people who thought that we were going to have to come up with something really complicated to deal with this problem.
Are people concerned, though, that adding too much of certain nutrients? Are they thinking of it in terms of, say, like an algae bloom, where the reason the algae bloom happens is because there is an increase in the nutrients that the algae feed off of, and you have the bloom, and then the algae bloom itself has side effects of reducing oxygen and in the area, and all sorts of unintended side effects might occur should we increase the fertilization for an increase in bacteria for the digestion of the oil. Is there anything that people were talking about in that direction?
So that's a great question. So the basic idea here is that the oil actually inhibits growth of a lot of organisms. But these organisms that can degrade oil can withstand those toxic inhibitors. Mm-hmm. So they stay in that environment. So if you provide just the right amount of fertilizer so those organisms can grow, they will grow, they'll degrade the oil. When they run out of oil, they lose their normal food stuff, so they don't grow anymore and they die off. And so as the oil's cleaned up, you decrease the fertilizer, and these organisms that were very prevalent die out, and the organisms that were inhibited by the toxic oil can now grow up. This is what bioremediation is all about.
It sounds like it would be, if it works appropriately, if it works in the way that we intend it to, it sounds like it would be, a fabulous answer to the problem of having too much oil, of having this leak that's out there.
All of that's true. The one thing that is a huge challenge,
yeah,
it's never fast enough, and it's so dependent upon a variety of human decisions, like providing the funding and the people who need to go out and do these things. So it's not a foolproof solution because humans are involved. The microbes have it down.
Well, we wouldn't actually have to come up with a solution if humans weren't involved in the first place in this particular case.
So actually, this is an interesting thing that I don't know if many people realize, but there's a tremendous amount of natural oil leakage that occurs in the Gulf and in other regions that generate a fair amount of oil. And the reason there are microbes that can degrade oil is because they've been exposed to it for eons and eons, and it seems like a natural food source for them.
Right. And so if we go to the source, go to the places where oil is seeping, these seepage locations on the sea floors, collect bacteria from those locations, and do you culture them? Do you put them in big tanks and grow them and then just spread the bacteria over the ocean? Is that the idea of how the problem would be solved?
So no, the beauty of this thing is
just
that
the fertilizer.
They are there. It's just the fertilizer, right? I mean, it's like adding fertilizer and watching the weed sprout or watering.
I like it.
They're there. It's just, they just need these nutrients to grow fast enough to degrade the oil at the rate that we'd like to see it degraded.
Right. Is there any search for, I mean, I guess this is the direction of actual synthetic biology, where you can take bacteria that initially do this job, that have this as part of their lifestyle, and then add instructions that speed up their metabolism or that speed up the process in some way or another.
So people are working very hard on that, but so far, if you speed up the ability of the microbes to do this, there are other costs associated with that. For example, you have to have them in a big culture vat and pump the water through the culture vat, or you have to, are there expensive approaches associated with making them? So far, we really don't have anything better than what has evolved over a tremendous number of years and the microbes that already exist out in nature.
I think that's an interesting point or a good interesting question. Is it possible, how often are we going to be able to improve on what nature has already done?
I think that's a huge question. We have to remember that millions and millions of years of evolution are all experiments.
Exactly. It's just one experiment after another. There have been discarded results, and those are the branches of the tree of life that haven't gone anywhere. And then we have the successful experiments, the ones that have organisms that have thrived and multiplied and gone on to, you know, to exist in en masse on our, in our planet.
So let me tell you something else that's a very small thing, but I think cute, right? And yes, that is wine, right?
Wine. We like wine here. It's good.
Right.
Yes.
So people, many types of wine produced in large amounts, people add sulfur dioxide to maintain the quality of the wine, right? But there are a lot of people who are very sensitive to the sulfur dioxide. They get headaches, it causes hangovers, even if they haven't drank too much, or other types of allergic syndromes. So a group has been experimenting with adding sodium hypochlorite, and the initial results suggest that it looks as good as sulfur dioxide for maintaining the wine quality, and it doesn't have these negative side effects on humans. So it may be that we'll have a way of increasing wine production in the future without the nasty side effects.
That would be so. So the sodium hypochlorite, how, what exactly does that do differently than the than sulfur? How does it, is there an organism, is it a different organism you're working with in those cases?
It actually is, in fact, very similar to what the sulfur dioxide does in terms of modifying wine. So it basically is just an alternative that prevents contaminating microorganisms from taking over and changing the flavor that's imparted by both the yeast and certain bacteria that do something called a malolactic fermentation that gives certain wines a very distinct and enjoyable flavor.
Right. Right. So you want to have the yeasts multiply and give a nice flavor, and you want the bacteria that give the bad flavors to go away, and the salts actually do that without imparting any change to the flavor of the wine. That's great.
I might add that work was done by Ki-Sun Yu from Korea. And it really reflects the international nature of science, the fact that we really are one huge scientific community, and there's so much we have to learn from each other.
Yeah. Are you seeing much? Is there much growth in the area of microbiology in terms of international collaboration? I mean, we all food is one of the first places that I think about in terms of where every country is impacted. We have, you know, I go to the grocery store and I see mangoes from Chile or avocados from Mexico, or there were issues with the volcanic ash cloud stopping shipments of produce from Africa to Europe. And all of these food products have microorganisms on them, bacteria on them. Is there any international collaboration looking at how at the food supply and how microorganisms are involved?
There are huge interactions by scientists who are studying those processes, but coordinating all the countries to be able to follow the shipments and track the shipments so you can determine where and when a disease sprung up.
Right.
There aren't enough, I have to tell you. But people are working very, very hard on it. But it's such a problem because for many countries, they view any negative press as an economic disaster, right? So it all depends on if you're worrying about dollars or about people.
Yeah, yeah, true. But if you find out where, you know, a salmonella outbreak is coming from, or what things lead to a salmonella outbreak, you can put stopgaps in place, regulations in place internationally, so that the places where the food comes from all kind of have a similar regulation chain, and all have similar ways of determining what the microorganisms are and how and ways of keeping them at bay.
Absolutely. So actually, the FDA just, I believe, a week, maybe a couple weeks ago, came out with some new guidelines for how to track where food comes from, so you can follow disease. That largely came from the salmonella associated with peppers in Mexico a short while ago. But since we talk about salmonella, salmonella is my favorite organism.
I know,
in the whole
I bring
world.
It up.
One of the really interesting things about salmonella is the fact that we're seeing so much salmonella that's been transmitted by plants lately. It's phenomenal. Salmonella has always been transmitted by animals, by animal products like milk and so on. But it's only been in the last couple of decades that we've seen so much transmitted by vegetables, tomatoes, peppers, sprouts, and so on. And one of the reports at this meeting was looking at how salmonella has developed the ability to live inside of plants. And it looks like this is a newly evolved trait. And the report at the ASM meeting suggested that there are a whole set of genes that have nothing to do with infection in animals that allow salmonella to live inside of plants.
Is that something like making plants a vector for salmonella to get to animals and infect them pathogenically? Or is it, I don't know, that sounds really, or are these new strains of salmonella that are not related at all to the ones that infect humans?
So these are genes that have been acquired by salmonella that allow them to live inside of these niches. Like, for example, inside of tomatoes instead of just on the surface.
That doesn't sound good.
it has a huge impact on food safety, because when salmonella is living inside the tomatoes look perfectly healthy.
Right.
It's just the humans that eat them that look bad.
How do you protect against, if the bacteria are beginning to acquire genes that allow them to live differently in the environment, to actually exist inside of our food, of our food sources, that you can't tell the difference. I mean, what do we start having to do? How do you protect against something like that? How do you know where and when that salmonella is going to outbreak, and how?
So this relates to the very first part of your question. I think that the idea is to be able to track somebody who gets sick very quickly and then follow the food source back to where it came from and stop further shipments of that food, so you can prevent something from happening very quickly. It's also true that in many cases, if you know something about the field, the amount of contamination in the wastewater or wild animals in that region or things of that nature, that it will tell you this is where we need to put the dam to prevent the food from coming through and making people sick.
I wonder what can be looked at as well in terms of what factors are leading to the transmission of these genes, the sharing of these genes between the organisms, so that they're enabled to move into these new niches, because in effect they're starting to encroach into a new habitat, right?
Absolutely. I think that that's a huge problem. But so one of the studies at the ASM general meeting was where people went out and looked at E. coli 0157H7. So this is the E. coli that causes the particularly nasty foodborne illness with subsequent kidney failure in children. And they asked the question, if you go through and look at fields in Central California and you look at the wild animals, do you find wild animals carrying this pathogen where they could transmit it to the water that's used to irrigate plants and so on? And in fact, it was they found it very readily out there. They found it in cowbirds and in crows. So not only does the animal have to get in the field, but birds can just fly over the field, and bird droppings transmit the disease. So we're never going to be able to totally eliminate these types of diseases. But if we can track the sources more quickly, we may be able to at least decrease the incidence.
We're getting towards the end of the hour here, and I'm just curious, are you really excited? And do meetings like the general meeting this last week just get you very excited about the direction that the field of microbiology is going? I mean, I was looking at the news and was just, you know, infatuated with the idea that these little tiny creatures, these little different organisms, have such an impact on our lives, and we still know so little about them.
I'm hugely excited. You know, there was a period of time where microbiology seemed like some kind of sub-discipline of biology, and I really feel that microbiology is a part of all of biology. I think that the discoveries we've made lately tell us that microbes have such an influence on virtually everything we do that it makes it really exciting. It makes the field of biology whole. It doesn't matter if you're tiny or if you're huge. Mm. The relationships between organisms is really key for us to understand, and we have the tools now to look at things we couldn't look at a short time ago. And I think that being able to discover new things is what gets scientists excited.
I think you're definitely right on that one. And in terms of looking into the future in kind of a science fiction-y kind of way, with microbes definitely involved, do you have any predictions to make for maybe the next year or two or three in terms of exciting discoveries you see on the horizon?
I think the huge discoveries on the horizon are going to come from the process of metagenomics, which is where you determine DNA sequence of whole populations of organisms in nature or on a human or whatever. You don't necessarily separate them out. It's going to tell us a lot about interactions between genes and metabolic processes in nature. The key thing that I think is really critical is we have a lot of these new techniques, but we can't answer all the questions with new techniques. We really do need the basic processes of biochemistry and genetics to sort through a lot of the information we've learned from omics. So I think it's going to be a very exciting next year and next decade.
Thank you so much for joining me today, Dr. Molloy. Stanley, it's been just so interesting, and the hour has flown by, honestly. I've just been
thank you very much, Kiki. It was really nice talking with you and all of the listeners.
Yeah, thank you so much, and I wish you all the best in your research. We hope you find all sorts of interesting information, and I'll be keeping track. I'll be keeping tabs on you.
All right. Take care.
Thank you very much. You take care as well.
Bye.
Bye. That was Dr. Stanley Molloy from San Diego State University. He is the director of the Center for Microbial Sciences, the associate director for Center for Microbial Sciences at San Diego State. And we were talking about the association, or the American Society for Microbiology's general meeting, and the news that was coming out of it this last week. And there's all sorts of microbial science that hopefully I'll be able to follow up on during the next year and even beyond. I find it fascinating, the little tiny things that live amongst us. I'm Dr. Kiki, and this has been the Science Hour. If you are interested in getting in touch with me, you can Google me, Dr. Kiki. I'm out there. My email is drkiki@drkiki.tv, and you can Twitter me. I'm at Dr. Kiki. Additionally, if you want to download past episodes of this show, you can find us in iTunes in the Twit Network, or you can actually go to twit.tv/Kiki, and I'm right there. I'm right there for you. And I guess that's about it. Until next week, when we will be talking about bonobos. I'm excited about that one. Sexy monkeys, that's what we'll be talking about next week. So stay tuned until then. In the meantime, there's much more here on the Twit Network. Keep watching.